Okay, with the floating format, next hour, geologist Jim Berkland joins us as we talk about the activity of earthquake swarms at Yellowstone. When we come back, we'll take a full hour of phone calls with you and James Norman on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, James Norman, our special guest, and your phone calls this hour. James, give us a prediction the next 6 months or so. Where do things stand? Oil, economy, credit?
I think we're going to bump along here for a while, but I think the trend is going to be down for a while. I think things are still very weak. It's like a patient that's kind of in a coma here. Ultimately, things will recover. Life will go on. But I think that the stakes here are very high. I think that at risk for the Russians is, and for the Chinese is, actual regime change of those governments. What's at risk for us is the loss of our status as the holder of the world's reserve currency. If we lose that, then I think you would get into a protracted credit problem with inflation and so forth. We would be harder for us to export our inflation. But I think we're going to win that battle. Can I make two quick points?
Yes.
One, just to remind people that the 800 number for trying day is 1-800-556-2012. And then secondly, you know, you had mentioned in the last hour about Leo Wanta, and we got into talking about that bank spying effort through systematic. I just wanted to mention a friend of mine who passed away this last year. His name was James Orland Graby, who he's a former Wharton finance professor who kind of tipped me off to systematics because he courageously posted on the Internet a whole list of press releases about Systematics, this company that's involved. And I talked to him later, why did you do that? He said, well, because he had started his own software company selling foreign exchange risk management stuff to banks. The National Security Agency came to his company and said, we want to put our people in your company so we can watch what goes on inside these Wall Street investment banks.
Oh, my God.
And that's when Orland said, I'm out of here. This is crazy. What they said was, we want to do that just the way we did at Systematics. So that's when he actually began what was one of the first blogs on the Internet back in 95, where he actually started posting a whole series of incredible stuff. And he knew what he was talking about because he had actually written the basic textbook on international financial markets. He was no dummy. He was clued in, and I think he had some prior relationship with the intelligence community himself, so he went after this whole thing, the Foster thing, and it's much to his credit that a lot of this stuff became public, including some of the Leo Wanta stuff.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll go to Douglas in San Francisco, west of the Rockies. Hey, Douglas, go ahead.
Hi, thanks so much as always. I hope that your holiday season went well, Mr. Norrie.
It went well, Douglas, as I trust yours did too.
Yes, thank you for asking. And Mr. Norman, I want you to know that I will make it a priority to read your book. And I want to thank you very much for blessing us with your time tonight. We're all pointed in the same direction, but I'm certainly have some different perspectives on this. I was born in Taiwan, so I've got a lot of perspectives on China, and I do want to say that you're absolutely right in your paradigm that the United States has done a lot of things in terms of manipulation towards its advantage. Like before World War II, it supported communism in China and in Vietnam, and that was for market denial. It took those nations out of the world market for over a quarter of a century. And certainly I was in the Kuwaiti campaign, and I can verify that both in that campaign and in the Gulf War after that, depleted uranium was combusted in very large amounts. It's still being combusted today for structural disintegration when they're attacking snipers and structures, and it has spread a lot of radiation that is leading towards area denial. Undeniably, you know, the U.S. government doesn't seem to care that massive cellular damage occurs within the bodies of in-country GIs, but obviously anyone who comes after the Americans pull out will have to perform radically expensive decontamination to exploit the resources of that nation. But this brings us back down to what's the long-term repercussions of this. There's a lot of short-term gain that America gets out of these manipulations, but But China today, in particular, is in the same situation in many ways that Japan was in before the Second World War. So obviously, you're right. They're going to undergo a massive regime change. They're going to disintegrate. But since they're the industrial rust belt of the world, that's not really good for anybody in the world economy. And obviously, we're all going to undergo worldwide just major collapse when this all falls down. So are you under the impression that the U.S., not just in Alaska, but elsewhere, perhaps off coast, still retains, you know, do they really retain large reserves of petroleum? Because otherwise, they've slave-circuited their entire foreign policy to basically the House of Saud, if all the reserves are there. If we ran out of all the reserves we had in World War II with supplying all of the Allies, which we did, because the North Sea oil fields weren't discovered in Britain at that time, and Russia hadn't developed any oil infrastructure of any worth at that time, we obviously used a lot of oil during that time. Right. So did we run out, or is there more there?
Thanks for calling, Doug. Let me give it to you, my take on it. It depends how you do the accounting. Depends how you do the accounting as to just how short or long the United States is. If you think of the United States going beyond its own borders, you know, if you count Canada and Mexico, who are really very close friends of ours, who we would support in any case, even if oil prices are low, and if you count the Saudis as being in our camp as well, plus you count the equity holdings of U.S.-based oil majors and U.S. stock holdings of foreign international majors, you could actually get to the point where you could argue that the United States is actually long on crude. It's hard to actually run those numbers, but instead, nominally we import about, I guess it's like 10 million barrels a day, something like that, of crude and refined product, maybe 12 million barrels a day. But if you look at it in a much bigger picture, we're probably net-net about even. Now, as far as China, what would happen if China fell apart? You know, would it be a disaster for the world? Well, it would be a disaster for the communist elite that runs that country, but, I mean, life would go on. I mean, the factories might still operate, but what you would have is China perhaps devolving into what had been a characteristic pattern for the last several hundred years, which is regional fiefdoms, warlordism, dynastic kind of control. In fact, doesn't Chinese friends of mine note that, you know, China has historically been run by 9 dynasties, and every one of them is just waiting patiently for the day to come when they'll have it back again.
All right, very good. Next up, we'll go to Vinny in British Columbia, international line. Vinny, go ahead.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good. Thank you.
Actually, it was partly covered in the last statement there, but I guess I was sort of wondering with Canada, we're, you know, fairly industrious nation, but we're kind of a small brother on the block with an army to size. But I guess I was just sort of wondering, what is your, I guess, strategic outlook for Canada as far as not only being a supplier of the oil and other resources to the States, but effectively being so close, that do you feel that it's going to be more of a pressurized guarantees put on the Canadian government, or do you think that, you know, I live in Canada, so I'm sort of wondering whether our government has a strategic place to sort of assert more sovereignty? Because right now up here, you know, we're slowly, you know, the things that our government has quietly signed or created, it's frankly pretty scary.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, Canada marches in lockstep with the United States on everything that really matters,
right,
particularly national security stuff. And that's really where the rubber meets the road. I mean, you know, various superficial domestic policy issues, people will yammer about that, and that those fights will go on forever. But when it comes to the real essentials, Canada and the U.S. are just linked at the hip, as we are with the U.K., basically with Europe, Mexico. I mean, the United States has a formidable array of allies, and we function more and more integrally in terms of our banking and financial relationships. And, in fact, I think eventually we will move to some kind of a de facto North American EU kind of relationship, you know,
I think we've already moved a long way in that direction. Countries will maintain nominal sovereignty, but functionally they'll operate in a very integrated fashion.
So in that sense, so in that sense, what do you actually think of India? Because in a way, you're considering that Canada is basically the U.S. to some degree internationally. You've got the EU, which is supposedly one big power. Besides Russia, China, India is basically the next big power that historically tries to stay somewhat neutral as far as...
Well, as I mentioned in a book, I think India has really come into its own in light of the U.S.-China rivalry. We've basically made a huge tilt toward India, basically pulled them away from the Soviet orbit, and we have really propped them up as a foil against China. I mean, we've poured in lots of, I think, technical and financial support to help India get up on its own 2 feet in terms of its own energy supply. And I think that, as I point out in the book, part of the Chinese strategy for dealing with their oil shortage situation was a going-out strategy to try and acquire equity reserves in Central Asia, Africa, all over the globe. And virtually everywhere the Chinese have gone to try and buy crude oil rights, the Indians have been right there at our behest, I think, bidding them up. So the Chinese have never gotten any bargains anywhere they go for this oil. They've had to pay through the nose. They generally win the contest, but the Indians are right there bidding them up.
What's funny, though, but the Indians sort of historically and as part of the socio mindset of the people today and even of yesterday, which is, partly because of the religion too, but they don't really care, they're very fascinated by international events, but they would never really pick sides. So yes, they would probably bid up the Chinese, but I sort of get the feeling that once this is all said and done and all the house of cards fall down, that the survivors probably will be the ones who have restrained from having international strategies, and I think India would probably be one of those countries. I mean, China's great, very strategic, but what happens if the strategy fails?
Right. Well, I think it does pay to stick to your knitting if you're a country even the size of China and India. But, I mean, make no mistake about it. The Indians and the Chinese don't get along. They fought several wars. They still have unsettled border disputes. They're commercial rivals on many fronts. And, the Chinese have been moving to, establish a naval base in Pakistan, increase their presence in the Indian Ocean. This does not make the Indians feel real comfortable.
They're getting strong in the Bahamas, as we know.
Yeah, I think, the Indians and the Chinese are both going to be competitors for scarce raw materials for their industrial base. So I think you're going to see an intensifying rivalry there. And the United States is clearly tilted toward India in that regard.
Okay, next up, let's go to Patrick in New Jersey, east of the Rockies. Hey, Patrick, go ahead.
Hello, George. Happy New Year to you and your guests.
Thank you, Patrick. You too.
I was just curious, two questions. With the state of the oil prices being what they are and being so cheap, what's the future for the alternative fuels such as alcohol? And the second question, I read a book a number of years ago called The Seven Sisters. It was a history of the oil companies in America and their dominance of the world oils. And in the book, there was a chapter that dealt with the establishment of Israel. And it said that Truman was perplexed as to what to do with the Jews. And the State Department said, well, don't worry about it, Harry. We'll let the oil companies take care of it. They're basically our undercover agents, you might say. And I was just curious, is the State Department really just a front for the oil companies?
Actually, there is a crucial relationship there, but I think it's the other way around. I think the oil companies really are, you could look at them as being tentacles of the national security apparatus. In fact, in the book, I go into some detail about how during the Truman administration, actually, Harry Truman tried to go after the oil companies on a criminal antitrust investigation for collusion. He was advised against that by his national security people,
and ultimately bowed to pressure. The case became merely a civil case and was settled for peanuts down the road because at the time the United States government needed the oil majors on board regarding Iran. At that time, we were trying to fight off the Russians in Iran, and the oil majors were key elements there to, you know, moving people, equipment, money, who knows what they were doing there. But, I mean, and it's interesting, you know, the Chinese, when the Chinese analyze the U.S. and other Western major oil companies, they regard them as if they were state-owned enterprises. Think about that. I mean, as I note in the book, the only way you can make these prices move the way they do is if the major oil companies, particularly Exxon, Chevron, the really big guys, behave properly. And what you see is that during the early 80s, when we were trying to flood the market with oil, bring the price down, Exxon ramped up its production like mad, violated all of its internal investment rules, spent way too much money, but dramatically raised its production. That helped bring the price down. And at the time we were trying to run the price up against the Chinese, Exxon was sitting on mountains and mountains of cash, no debt, wouldn't put the money back in the ground, could have been producing a lot more, left money on the table. Again, I think it's because they were abiding by what the government wanted. And in fact, Lee Raymond, the CEO of Exxon, every time he got hauled before Congress to testify about these outrageous prices, he told them over and over again, look, these prices are mainly a function of geopolitics. He wouldn't explain it any more than that. I don't think he could. But that's his point. You know, geopolitics is setting these prices. Don't blame us at the oil companies.
How much did Dick Cheney know about all this?
Well, I think Cheney is probably the locus of awareness in the government of all this stuff. I think he is the national security point guy in the White House. I think the whole National Security Council staff runs out of his office some way. And he was around during the 80s, during the Reagan era, when we were busting the Soviets on these prices. He knows, I'm sure, exactly how the game's played in it. And
plays it well, doesn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah.
Strategic Petroleum Reserve, how does that fit into this entire picture?
Well, that's another variable that can be used here. I mean, if you want to take barrels off the market, you buy them up and put them in the ground. That helps raise the price. If you want to soften up the price, well, you stop buying crude or even sell some of it. And you can actually, even small amounts of crude movements in and out of the SPR can have a marked effect on the market price, partly because the key thing you're dealing with there is a particular grade of crude, light sweet crude. Now, there's not that great a supply of that kind of crude on the world market. It's only like 20% of the world crude that gets traded. So if you're taking relatively small amounts of that on or off the market, you can move the price around. And I think that's partly what's resulted in this recent run-up. Crude's gone from like $39 a barrel up to hit 50 the other day. It's like 49 now. Partly it's because the Chinese announced that they were buying crude for their strategic reserve, and that the DOE said that they're going to resume buying crude, which we stopped back in June buying crude for that. I think that contributed to the price drop.
We'll be back in just a moment with more with James Norman and your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Ghost Fest 3, Sunday afternoon, January 25th, on the Queen Mary in Long Beach, California. I'll be there from 1 to 3, so make sure you're part of that. There's more information on the coasttocoastam.com website. Click on my calendar schedule and then click Ghost Fest 3. That's January 25th, Sunday, 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. in Long Beach, California. And welcome back to Coast, James Norman with us, author of the book, The Oil Card. Interested, the phone number, 800-556-2012. The website, of course, is also theoilcard.com. Jim, let's go to final calls. You ready?
Sure.
Here we are. Let's go to Bob in North Hollywood, California. Hey, Bob, go ahead.
Hey, gosh, finally you got a guy who really knows what's going on here with energy.
He sure does.
Man, this is great. Fantastic. I've been talking about this for years on the Art Bell Show, talking about how the president, the current administration, is manipulating oil and energy and all this stuff. And I even predicted that if we got a Democratic president, you'd see the price of oil dramatically drop, which happened. And so what the thing is, that with the new administration, we actually heard Obama actually say that he was going to remove the corruption from the current administration. Gee, I wonder what he meant by that. Corruption? Let's think. Manipulation? But I looked into this for a long time, and you're right. There is an intelligence network into this, manipulating this. There is a national security aspect, and a central intelligence agency is connected definitely to this project. As you know, that the black budget, the CIA had a low budget, and Clinton really was strangling the CIA, and now we had a major boost in the CIA's profit-taking from all these little manipulations here with energy and oil and stuff. And if you've known Dubai, the money was being laundered through Dubai. As you notice that Dubai, the economy has boomed since this artificial oil shortage took place, and now since the Obama administration is coming into place and they're shutting down this black operation, the oil prices are dropping. Now Dubai is bankrupt. They're completely bankrupt now. So it's an interesting play that I'm trying to figure out. What do you think with the new Obama administration? I know for a fact that oil prices will reach 99 cents a gallon for maybe, you know, a week or two or whatever, but he's going to make sure that there's an offset from what was misappropriated at the oil companies, and they're going to probably make it 99 cents for maybe a few months or a year or whatever. But the official price, what I heard, is $1.49, where we're going to stabilize the oil prices at the Obama administration. Do you concur with this information?
Well, somewhat. My take, though, is that again, there's a national security agenda that's going on here. This is a permanent government at work. And regardless of who's in the White House, whatever cardboard cutout we have as a president at the moment, it almost doesn't matter, because there's an ongoing strategy here that it crosses party lines. It just goes on and on. And I think it's going to periodically move prices up, move prices down. I think right now, as long as we're going after the Russians, we're going to see a downward trend in prices. And in fact, one of the prior callers actually asked about alternative fuels. What does that do for alternative fuels? Ironically, I think what you're going to see is the government will pour more money into alternative fuels, even though they're not particularly economic, just to add more pressure to crude prices. So you're going to see more subsidies going into all this green kind of stuff. As I said before, I think you're going to see a new wave of fuel economy standards imposed on Detroit, again, at a time when we don't really need them, again, to further reduce demand. It's going to soften up the crude market. You're going to see low prices could go on for as long as it takes, I think, to achieve regime change in Moscow and possibly China as well. I think that I wouldn't look for any dramatic change in fundamental policy from the new administration.
Okay, thanks for that, Jim. Let's go to Houston, Texas. Julie, thanks for calling. You're on with us.
Yes.
Hi.
Oh, hi. Fascinating program. Originally, I was I had one question, but it pretty much was answered. I wanted to ask you what you thought about the drilling going on by Russia in the Arctic regions. Apparently, they're claiming stake to land up there or something. Do you think that'll have any impact on, you know, on us, or are we going to go up there and do some exploration? Or?
Well, the Russians have tried to grab claims to huge chunks of the Arctic Sea going all the way to the North Pole. Yeah, we're probably going to contest him on that. I think that turf ought to be up for grabs internationally.
Do you think we're going to wait until they find the oil and then we'll contest it?
No, I think we're already contesting it.
Oh, okay.
But I don't think the Russians really have the capabilities of exploring in those kind of Arctic waters, particularly deeper waters, the way we do. I mean, what you have to realize about the oil business, the United States and its allies really control this business in terms of the money, the hardware, the technology. Nobody comes close to the U.S. and the Western oil industry, the majors, in finding oil and producing it. The Russian companies are leagues behind, and the Chinese companies are still in the dark ages.
Mm. Well, thank you.
Sure.
Okay, next up, let's go to College Station, Texas. Preston, it's your turn. Hi, Preston.
Good evening.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to say it's really good to see that somebody looks outside the box, and I completely agree with you on the situation as far as oil goes with Russia.
And I'm outside the box, all right, yeah.
Well, I've been thinking this for the last 6 months. I travel to Russia very much. I'm very involved in Russian nationalist politics. Curious of what you're thinking. You keep saying regime change in Russia, Putin being gone. Are you familiar with the rise of nationalism in Russia right now?
I've noted that. I mean, from afar, I'm an oil guy. I really don't follow Russian politics in detail, but I know there's a very vociferous nationalist movement there. In fact, that has come into play vis-a-vis the Chinese. You know, they, as I mentioned earlier in the show, the Chinese have kind of Finlandized Siberia by just a large migration of Chinese nationals into Siberia. And there's the nationalist crowd in Russia has gotten extremely concerned about this, about the ethnic dilution of Russian control over Siberia. And I think that's been a big issue for them.
And not just Siberia. I mean, Russian nationalism, Russia's on the verge of becoming a national socialist nation. And I'll give you the big hint on how this will occur. You're familiar with Dmitry Rogozin, Russian ambassador to NATO?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was paid off to be there because he was gaining an extreme amount of popularity. They did not allow him to have a party to run for president last time around.
He was the head of the Nationalist Party, I think, wasn't he?
He was head of Rodina, and he was co-founder of DPNI, Movement Against Illegal Immigration. And we literally have tens of thousands of people out in the streets every year protesting the Russians or Putin's policy on letting illegal immigrants into Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And him being ambassador to NATO, well, recently the Kremlin to satisfy the budget laid off 250,000 officers in the military.
That's not real healthy for their job security at the Kremlin, I don't think.
Well, you figure that, and you've got somebody that is at the level of ambassador to NATO for Russia. Got quite a few contacts, and we really see revolution in the next year, 18 months. They're expecting 1 million unemployed Russians by next year. Right now, or last year, there were probably 1 million unemployed Russians, and the underemployment is just growing by leaps and bounds.
I think that's true. Yeah, I mean, you're seeing, you know, as I mentioned before, bank liquidity problems, bank mm-hmm. runs in effect, naked store shelves, people not getting paid. I mean, people are not going to put up with this very long, but the point you make about Putin allowing immigrants into the country, to me, that's another example of the weak hand that he's got to play. I mean, you've got Russia basically with a declining population. Its wealth is entirely dependent on the export of raw materials, mainly to its archenemy, China. This is not a healthy situation. It's a recipe for disaster. And I think that you're going to see, I think, tragic things unfold in Russia over the next year or so. I'm with you on that.
Quicker than China?
Yeah, I think so. The, you know, China, well, I don't know. China could disappear overnight. I mean, that was the
You're that serious? It could fall apart that fast?
I think so. Look, all it would take would be for some military commander in China to say, I'm not going to obey those orders. And I think the rather small elite that runs the Communist Party
75 people, I hear.
They would run for the hills. They would just be gone. It would be, look at how the Soviet Union fell. There wasn't a shot fired, and supposedly the CIA had no clue about it before it happened. Right.
Yeah.
But they just ran out of money, and they went away. And seeming chaos followed, but, you know, life goes on.
The problem with these collapses, John, James, is because they've got nukes.
Well, that's right, and that makes them prickly to deal with. But again, you know, if you take away their ambitions to extend geopolitical influence, the nukes become kind of an academic issue. They're more of a, you know, it's like that $2 trillion of dollars that they hold. They're more of a liability than an asset. They're very expensive to maintain, and they don't do you much good. So,
let's go to Brooklyn, New York. Jimmy, east of the Rockies, you're up with us. Hey, Jimmy.
Hi. The CIA had prior warning that the Soviet Union was going to collapse. They got it from the most important Soviet defector ever, a man named Anatoly Golitin, who defected in 61, and he told U.S. intelligence that the Soviet Union, the whole intelligence apparatus, was reorganized after the death of Stalin. And he went back to the Leninist model, which is massive subversion and deception.
Right.
Now, Golitin was destroyed in this working in the CIA when Nixon wanted to open relations with China, and then Nixon and the guy after him ended up firing the counterintelligence chief Angleton. So they totally discounted everything Golitin said, even though history has shown now out of 150 predictions, he's proved to have been right 146 times.
Oh, I'm sure the CIA knew Russia was going to come down.
It's a deception, though. What I'm saying is a deception. The strength, you don't measure a strength in a country by the amount of missiles they have. It's also political, cultural, and social strength.
Right.
America is collapsing, too. And if you look at what the Soviet operations in Latin America, they're strengthening Cuba, Venezuela. Wherever there's energy, the Soviets or the Red Chinese are there. The stated goal of the Soviets was to take control of the energy, the treasure trove of minerals that are the West life support system. And now, you know, the Soviet front group in Washington, the Institute for Policy Studies, one of their key guys, is about to be heading the CIA.
Well, you know, frankly, I think when you see Russia cuddling up with Hugo Chavez and those kind of people, I think of two drunks on the sidewalk leaning against each other trying to prop themselves up from falling down.
Well, see, that's the weak look. If you never underestimate your enemy, because the power they have within America with the Popular Front, United Front political movements, and Leon Panetta was a big guy with the Institute for Policy Studies, the Soviet front group. So they have enormous political power in this country. Remember, the Chinese communists are on record as saying if half the world died in a nuclear war, it wouldn't be so bad because the new world would be communist. If the current Russian or Chinese government collapses, the new government will be communist,
right,
either open or secret.
Well, I have no doubt that whatever dirty tricks we're doing against those other bad guys, they're doing the worst to us. It's going on all over the place in both directions. So
let me give you one more thing you're going to find interesting. The Red Chinese in Queens here used the Falun Gong, a group I like, an anti-communist group. They used the Falun Gong to defeat an anti-communist state assemblywoman, Ellen Young, and got in a lady named Grace Meng, whose father represents communist China. So the communists outsmarted the Falun Gong and got them to do the dirty work. Now we have a pro-communist city state assemblywoman in Queens, New York. Also in San Francisco, Mr. Leung, an anti-communist Chinese leader, was murdered after being threatened by the Red Chinese for his pro-democracy activities. So they're doing enormous work in America. The radical left, Marxist, you know, you see this Bill Ayers, his people in the schools. So if you look at what you see as the weakness in China and Russia and only look at that, without also looking at the weakness of us, we could have a million missiles. But if the enemy is here and takes political power, you know, there's different ways of measuring power.
Right. No, I think you're exactly right. And I don't mean to minimize that. I think the United States is not invulnerable to this. And in fact, at one point in the book, I actually mentioned, you know, we're really in a race to oblivion with the Chinese on this. I mean, we have mismanaged our own finances terribly.
How do you know it's mismanaged? How do you know it's mismanaged? How do you know it's not on purpose? The movement for world government, I've only really studied the communist part of it, but the U.S. government in the early 50s, the Rees Committee to investigate the tax-exempt foundations, came to the conclusion that the major tax-exempt foundations in America are working to insert us into a world government. Zygmunt Brzezinski wrote a book on it. He supports world government. And there was somebody else, I just can't remember now. Oh, Professor Quigley, Bill Clinton's mentor in Tragedy and Hope, I believe it is, talks about both parties are like a false opposition to each other. They're all working toward world government, and he supports it. So the communist end of it was violent revolution. The part in America was peaceful revolution. But since the 80s, the Soviet press talk about the peaceful evolution to world socialism, and they call the European Union the new Soviet Union. Gorbachev does. So at one point, there's the illusion of growing democracy, but if you look at it objectively, you see that there's also a growing world Marxist movement.
Yeah. Well,
I agree with you. Things are never what they appear to be.
That's exactly right.
As far as the world government, I guess that's above my pay grade. I'm still stuck back thinking about national security issues and traditional alliances. But I hear you.
All right, time for one or two more calls, Tampa, Florida. Go ahead, Michael, you're on with James Norman.
Hello, thank you.
Sure.
One thing that I think could be, and hopefully it doesn't come to pass, is that with the U.S. Looking like it's going to add several tens of thousands of troops to the Kandahar region of Afghanistan, that there could be a potential flashpoint involving all those countries in the region, India, China, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran, for a variety of reasons, but for the reasons that are being discussed today, it would be about oil lines and port cities and markets, really. I mean, there are borders that aren't set between China and India, India and Pakistan, you know, with Kashmir still undecided. The Chinese have a border with Pakistan, and they're developing rail lines in the country, so to get to the Arabian Sea and these types of issues. And I'm wondering, a pipeline that goes from Iran through Pakistan to India for energy, for natural gas, would this be a flashpoint with the additional U.S. troops in Afghanistan and possibly activity in Pakistan?
Right. Well, in effect, it's been a flashpoint for several years. In fact, as I mentioned in the book, it talks about Iraq, why we went into Iraq to basically preempt Chinese occupation of oil fields there. As far as Afghanistan is, you know, when we – that was the first place we went after 9/11. We garrisoned Afghanistan. Now, the significance of that is that that's really the high ground between China and Central Asia. And I think that we've had a policy to try and discourage Chinese encroachment into Central Asia, particularly Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, lots of oil and gas there. And you're right. I mean, there's intense pipeline politics going on all over that subcontinent region there. You know, the Chinese want to build a pipeline through Burma to avoid having to go through the Malacca Straits. Pakistan is kind of looks like it's kind of in play some way. I think that the reason we're moving troops into Afghanistan, I don't think it's just because of the Taliban. I think there are probably other larger strategic issues there.
Absolutely. The oil card, Jim Norman. Jim, thanks for being on the program.
It's been great fun. Great questions from your callers also. Thanks for your time, George.
They're the greatest. We'll be back in a moment now with an hour of Jim Berkland, geologist, as we talk about Yellowstone.